What's up, everyone? This is Mike Cashew, and you're listening to the Brute Strength Podcast. In this week's episode, I talked to my good friend Bryce Astle. He tells his story of his near-death experience in Peru, in which he spent over 10 days in a medically induced coma, all the way up to running a 100-mile race in less than 6 months. This guy's story is absolutely incredible. I hope you enjoy the show. What's up, everyone? This is Mike Cashew, and you're listening to the Brute Strength Podcast. I'm here with one of my best friends in the world, Bryce Astle. Bryce, appreciate you making some time, man.
Thanks, man. Happy to be here. Honored to be on your podcast.
So many of you know Bryce as the guy that we posted about a few months ago that was in the ICU in Peru. And I could talk to this guy about a million different things. But I think first off, let's start with that story. So I was in Arizona at the time with a D, and I get this text all of a sudden from our friend Brian. And he said, "Hey man, have you heard from Bryce?" And I knew Bryce was in Peru. I knew you were in Peru. And I was a little bit worried, that Bry had reached out, because him and I don't talk that often and stuff like that. So I was a little concerned. And before long, I think he's the one that told me. I think he said, he's in the ICU over there. And it didn't really dawn on me what the ICU means in general. I just thought, oh shit, he had some hiking accident. I hope he's okay. And over the next couple days, 2, 3, 4 days, I realized that there was a big chance that he was going to die. And the worst point was when his sister Aubrey called and asked if I would escort his mom out to Peru, because so that in case he dies, she was there by his side. And so that was a terrifying moment. Ended up going over there and spending about 2 weeks with his family. And we'll kind of start there. Bryce, can you tell us a little bit about that story for those who weren't kind of keeping up with the GoFundMe stuff?
So I was in Peru just for fun. I usually travel during the wintertime, try to go out of the country to just go explore. And I had been in, I'd flown into Lima, Peru, spent about 4 days there, and then took a overnight bus to a mountain town about 8 hours northeast of Lima, in the Andes, called Huaraz. And that town's about 10,000 feet. And when I got there, I felt like I was getting a cold, and I just figured I had like a really shitty night of sleep on the bus. I was like, oh, I'm just getting a little cold. I was planning on doing some trekking. All the mountain ranges, or the big mountain range that I was going to be in around there, is most of the peaks are, anywhere from 15 to 20,000 feet. And so it's all high elevation stuff. So I was like, man, with a cold, like I'm going to get, the elevation is going to mess with me. So I just slept for a couple of days at this hostel just trying to get rid of my cold. And then I went up to another hostel up higher on the mountain, maybe around like 13,000 feet. The town of Huaraz is at 10,000 feet. And went up there, was planning on taking off on a solo trek around this mountain the next day. And that night, my breathing changed. My inhale was normal, and my exhale sounded really like gurgly and bubbly. And it was getting harder and harder to breathe. I knew something was wrong at that point. And, I was up on this mountain. There's no vehicles up there. There's two taxis in the whole town that will come up there. And so I knew I was stuck there till at least, the next morning, possibly later. And, so I was, that was for me, actually, that was like one of the scariest moments. 'Cause I was just like, man, I hope I don't like die tonight. 'cause my breathing had changed so much. And, but I found if I slept on my side, the liquid would like run out of my airway and I could sleep. And so I kind of did that all night. Every time I'd turn, I'd like start gurgling again and have to like change positions, and got a really rough night of sleep, woke up in the morning, and went from like having what felt like a slight cold to barely being able to stand up. I was coughing up blood, and and couldn't breathe very well. And luckily got a taxi off the mountain about mid morning that day. And it's really awesome taxi driver named Americo.
Nice.
he was super cool. So he actually drove me to the private hospital that I ended up at after the public hospital, said something to them in Spanish that my Spanish sucks. And then we left there and he took me to the public hospital. And, so they checked me in there. They diagnosed it as, pneumonia and pulmonary edema. They probably thought it was high altitude pulmonary edema, cause that's pretty common to get in those mountains. Especially for people coming from out of the country and stuff. So, they got me on oxygen, which was awesome. That felt great. Got me in a hospital room, and I just continued to get worse. By the second day, my lungs were, the lung x-ray, your lung x-ray should be mostly black. Mine was all white, except for maybe like a quarter or 50 cent size piece of black in one lung. I think by the start of the third day, I remember the first 2 days pretty vividly. And then the start of the third day, there was two people that spoke English in the hospital. So when they were there, they would kind of fill me in on what's going on. They told me my lungs were like really, really bad. My biggest concern was I was just like, man, like this sucks. Like, I'm an ultra runner. Like I need my lungs. Like my biggest fear was that like, I wasn't going to be able to run again. but I had I thought, it's pneumonia. Like pneumonia kills like really old people and little kids. Like I'll be fine. But they'd asked if somebody from my family could contact the embassy about insurance. And so I was like, well, I don't really have a way to reach anybody without Wi-Fi. And so one of the male nurses gave me a Wi-Fi hotspot from his phone, and I was able to get a message off to my brother, pretty nonchalant. Of like, hey, I'm in this hospital with pneumonia and pulmonary edema. They want somebody from the family to call the embassy about insurance. He had called my dad. My dad called. I have two sisters. I have four sisters, but two of them are ICU nurses. And so one of them, she tried to call the hospital. And by the time she called the hospital, I was pretty out of it at that point. Like, I don't remember a whole lot. And after sending that message, but she called the hospital, there was nobody who spoke English at the time she called. She talked to the doctor. She remembered enough Spanish to know that I was in the ICU at that point in critical condition, but she couldn't understand exactly why. Mm-hmm. Her husband's aunt's from Peru and lives in, I think, Southern California. So she called her and was like, hey, Rose, I need you to call the hospital and find out everything that's going on. So she calls my sister back and is like, they've done everything they can at this hospital. They don't have the proper equipment. If we don't move him, he's going to die and it's going to happen soon. So they started calling hospitals. They found a private hospital a block away that had a ventilator. So at that point I needed a ventilator to survive. They call it getting intubated. And basically they stick a breathing tube down your throat and connect you to a ventilator, and they put you in a medically induced coma because obviously all of that's extremely uncomfortable. At that point they knew the pneumonia wasn't getting better with antibiotics. So at that point it's viral pneumonia, and it had developed into what they call ARDS, which is acute respiratory distress syndrome.
And I think like over 50% of people that are diagnosed with that end up dying, right?
Yeah, it's a pretty high rate. It's a pretty tough one to come through. And basically they put you in a coma. They work all these settings to keep your lungs and your body breathing and working while your body fights, does its job to fight the infection. Mm-hmm. But it's viral, so it just has to run its course. And so they got me moved to that hospital, which was about the last thing I remember. I remember getting put in an ambulance and then I remember getting wheeled into a new place. And thinking like, oh, this looks more like a normal clinic, because the hospital I was at was the public hospital. It looked kind of like an old rundown brick high school, and just, old hospital beds, lack of equipment, great doctors and nurses, just not a lot of the modern things that we're used to. So this place was a little more modern, and but that's about the last thing I remember. They immediately intubated, like put me in a coma and got me on that ventilator. My dad and my little sister got there the day after that I was intubated. And I was in that hospital for 3 days. I got my lungs improved initially because of intubation, and then I was showing no signs of improvement. My sister was super worried because they just weren't doing all the stuff they needed to get me better. And she had worked with ARDS patients and kind of knew like all the different tricks and stuff. And so she had gotten kicked out of the ICU fighting with the doctor, and they eventually they and the doctor like made the kind of made the choice of, hey, we've got to get him to Lima to a better hospital. So 8 hour ambulance ride to Lima, pretty like super risky, but that was about the best transport we could do, because flight wasn't an option at that point. They had looked into all that kind of stuff, and so got me there. That almost killed me. Like my heart almost stopped, and my lungs got quite a bit worse. And then fast forward to I think I was in the coma 11 days, total 11 or 12 days. Fast forward and waking up to see your beautiful face.
I remember the first time I went in the room. I don't remember exactly what I told you. I told you two jokes, and we laughed so fucking hard. I was like, Bryce, you have to stop. You have to stop laughing. This can't be healthy. It was just the I can't even describe the feeling of seeing you awake and alive. As I've told you repeatedly, the experience of that 10 days out there with your mom, your sister, and your dad was possibly the most powerful experience of my life. Just connecting with them and hearing all the, just everyone telling stories about you and what's the fucking meaning of life and all of this kinds of deep shit, because we were kind of knocked down to reality by this event. So it was, seeing you awake was just such an incredible feeling.
Super confusing for me. I remember, like, because you were telling me like what had happened, and I'm like, in my head, I'm like, what the fuck is going on? Like, I was, I just had pneumonia, and you're like, you're in a hospital in Lima. I was confused because I was like, I was so drugged that like I felt bad because I couldn't remember your last name, but I knew you were my best friend. So I kept like thinking your last name was like one of my best friends from junior high, Mike Binks, and I was like, no, that's not his last name. And I'm like, how shitty of a best friend am I? Like, he's standing by my deathbed. I can't remember his last name. And then I remember you showed me, that our friend Jenny had set up the GoFundMe, and I think at that point they'd already raised like $35,000 and all this stuff. And I remember being, I just instantly was in tears, and I mean, it was quite a wild experience to wake up to, really confusing, and but also, absolutely incredible to see like, your familiar face and my fam, some of my family. And I mean, I couldn't talk to any of you guys, which was like also crazy, because I had the tube in my throat and stuff, but it was pretty incredible.
What did you, I'm sure you learned a ton of different lessons, but if there's one that's maybe most prominent, what did you learn from that whole experience? What like perspective did you take from that?
I think if I was to like simplify it down to like the most simple lesson to take from that is like, the only, at the end of the day, like if you get at the root of life, like the only shit that matters is like family, friends, and the time you have with them, you know, and how important that is and how unimportant the rest of the bullshit is. Cause that, you know, laying there and contemplating like having almost been dead and all those things, like, you know, you start to think about the things that you would regret, you know, or that. And the only thing that I would regret is just not spending more time with the people I love. And the rest of it, you know, it's all kind of icing on the cake. But at the end of the day, like the people, yeah, the community and the people that you surround yourself with and the amount of, you know, the time you have with them, and especially the time in experiences, like doing things together, like that's the part that mattered, right. You know, that's the part that, that matters the most. The rest of it's all can all kind of fall by the wayside pretty easily as far as importance goes.
So there were literally thousands of people that contributed to your GoFundMe or just like raising the, spreading the word in general. And I've seen lots of different fundraisers for tragedies and stuff like this. But I don't think I've ever seen something as like, as explosive as, you know, something catch fire like your story did. And I think it's a big testament to your relationships with everyone that you meet. So, I mean, you're not some innocent child, you know, with cancer or something like that. You're this middle-aged white dude that, and everybody rallies around. So what is it about you, or rather, yeah, what is it about you that makes people feel so connected to you that they have this kind of reaction? They had that reaction.
Ooh, that's probably a better question to ask other people to get an accurate answer. But I think, you know, I guess if I have to answer that question, like, I think I like authenticity, I guess. I don't think I've always been an authentic person, and I think, you know, well, as you know, like I was a former, cocaine and heroin addict and spent a good portion of my life being extremely selfish that way. And, you know, for the last, 10 years, you know, I've been sober and just working, to kind of create a more authentic life and learn how to live happy and all that kind of stuff. And, I think one of the biggest things that, that I guess would cause like maybe people to have that experience with me is just that I think I genuinely want to love and help whoever I can. And that stems from, you know, being a part of communities that, that have taught me that that's kind of what life is about. Like, I thought I lived a good portion of my life, like wanting and hoping to be dead and avoiding and numbing out and trying not to feel anything. And, you know, I was taught some different ways to learn how to actually find happiness within myself and find peace within myself and do all those things. And man, if I can help even, you know, one person do that, even for a moment, you know, like I think life is kind of composed of just moment after moment. And the more of those like true, genuine, authentic, beautiful moments we can all experience without the bullshit of self getting in the way or expectation and all that kind of stuff, like, the better it is, you know. And I just like, that's to me, that's one of the things that life's about. And, yeah, I'm very, very committed and dedicated to helping others feel that, because it's something I never thought I could ever experience, you know? So maybe that's it. I honestly have no idea, man.
I think
tough question.
I have a couple, theories on it. And one of them to your point that you're kind of talking about is, I think you bring like this curiosity with you into every interaction you have with a person, whether you've known them for, you know, your entire life, or you're just meeting them, you have this curiosity about like, what's going on with you in your life? Tell me about your life. And you really genuinely try to get involved in that person's story. And at the end of the day, everyone wants to talk about themselves. They want to share, you know, their hopes, dreams, desires, what's going on with them. And you really insert yourself into their life, right? And yeah. So that's why I've had like cousins and all kinds of extended family members that have met you for, you know, a couple hours, and they still ask me about you, even though they met you say 5 years ago, right? How's that guy Bryce doing? That crazy fucking bearded guy, you know? And I think it's that curiosity that you bring, like you make people feel special. And I think when I did the podcast with Aaron from FitAid the other day, that's something that he does. He tries to figure out what's going on in someone's life and their business, and he really tries to give them some kind of – he tries to help them, right? Really yeah. genuinely tries to help them rather than just like, I don't know, just waiting for his turn to talk, if you will. Mm-hmm. With that said, you're a fucking great talker and you're a great storyteller.
I do love to talk. Yep. No, I think that's true. I am genuine. Like, I'm fascinated by what makes everybody tick, you know, and more, I guess more so by the root of like why, you know, why we do what we do. And, mm-hmm. and everybody's story is just, you know, there's so many similarities and there's also like little differences and stuff. And it's, you can just learn so much about a person and really about yourself too. You know, I think we're all mirrors of each other and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, that makes sense.
So when you started to recover from this, from your accident, what did you think about when you thought about running again? Where was your head at?
Well, I mean, you know, get it like, you know, being in the hospital in the ICU room, my goal was, I don't think I ever even thought about running that at all. It was just like, I was so focused on just getting out of the hospital.
Right.
And out of the ICU, as you know, I couldn't sleep and that was awful and everything else. And so when we had gotten released from the ICU into the normal hospital room, I remember, you know, we were kind of, I think, you know, I was lifting some water bottles over my head, which was like really heavy. And
oh, yeah.
We were finally kind of like reflecting on the collateral damage of like what this all did to my body. And I, you know, I'd lost 38 pounds. I looked like, I remember the first time I saw myself in the mirror, I looked like I had walked out of a concentration camp and I'd never, you know, it was, I think I weighed 132 pounds, which I don't think I had weighed that since I was in like seventh grade. And so we had started talking about like what it would take to rebuild, and that, you know, and in my mind I was like, yeah, like a couple months I'll be like back at it, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think I remember asking you, like, I'm like, how long do you think it'll take for me to like rebuild my muscle like back to like what it was or whatever? And I think you told me 6 months to a year, and or 9 months to a year or something like that, you know. And I was like, I remember that kind of floored me a little bit, and I was like, oh shit, like this is gonna be a much rougher process than I thought, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I remembered while we were in there, I remembered like, I was like, damn it. I signed up for the Bear 100, which is a 100-mile race through the mountains in Northern Utah. And I was like, you know, I was like, fuck, I'm not going to be able to do that now.
And for those of you who don't know, what race, how many races had you done before that? Ultras?
I had done four 100-mile races. Mm-hmm. and a few, like 3 or 4 50K distance and a 1 or 2 50 mile.
Right. So this wasn't your first race. This was just another race basically.
Yeah. Yeah. I hadn't raced for a couple of years. I'd kind of taken some time off to well, part of it was forced at first because of like a weird parasite I got in Costa Rica. I have some bad luck in, you know, Central and South American countries apparently, but, And then the next year I just took racing off because it was really nice to like have more time to spend with, you know, family and friends and my girlfriend at the time. I had like, you know, cause training for an ultra can take up a lot of extra time. And so I was really excited to like, I was feeling super healthy. I was feeling really strong. And I was like, I wanted to race again. And I wanted to try to be as competitive as I could be. And so, you know, so I had signed up with that to that race. Yeah. So not my first one, but definitely my first one in a while. And I was like really stoked about it. Yeah. So, yeah.
Lose your train of thought.
What's that? Well, what? Yeah, I did.
The question was what you thought when you considered running.
Oh, yeah, again, yeah.
And so, you started talking about your recovery.
Thank you. So, yeah, so, like, so I remember thinking, like, oh, shit, I'm not going to be able to do this race. And then I was like, well, maybe I will be able to. And then we started discussing it, and it sounded like a pretty big long shot, you know, based on, you know, I couldn't at that point. I was walking, barely walking unassisted. I think you guys were still always walking by my side, ready to catch me because I would fall over some or almost fall over some.
But I was pushing you. I was definitely yeah. pushing. I'd let go for a couple seconds. Oh, good job, Bryce. You're killing it.
Do it. Yeah, you made me do some. Michael made me do some quarter squats at the end of the hallway every time we get down there, which was hilarious. I did like my first step up in that room on like a 6-inch step up.
And you're fucking gassed for a half hour afterwards.
totally destroyed. Yeah. The water bottle, there's a video somewhere of like me doing water bottle snatches. And I like could not believe how much 1 liter water. So yeah, the thought of running again, it was like, well, when I get back, like I'm going to have to like focus on just walking. And then like maybe a couple months from then I'll be able to start running. And then, but that only gives me like 4 months before the race because the race was just this last weekend in September. And, but then, you know, in the hospital, your buddy and Sean Pastuch, Pastuch of Active Life RX had emailed you and offered to program for me, which was an amazingly kind gesture, you know, from somebody who didn't even know me, had never met me. And in his words, he's like, I saw you needed help. I knew I could help. So I wanted to help.
Right, man. Sean told me the other day that working with you has been one of, if not the most fulfilling experience in his professional career. So that's pretty fucking cool.
That's awesome. Well, I mean, I can't say enough about the guy, you know, as far as just that's a good dude right there.
Hell yeah.
What an attitude to take in the world that we all, you know, can learn from of just, you know, if you have the ability to help somebody and whether you know him or not, like help somebody,
right.
You know, that's a cool thing. So of course I took him up on that offer and, I don't think I had told him about the 100-mile race plan for quite a while. I think we just like focused on just, you know, just rebuilding, some basics. I think it was maybe a couple months after I got home I'd been hiking a lot and I'd been doing his programming and, you know, and I thought like, holy shit, like it's a real possibility. Like my body's like doing pretty well. Like maybe I can do it. And so you can drop from those races and get your money, you know, big portion of your money back up to a certain date. And so I figured I'm like, well, by the end of July, I'll have a good idea if I can do it. And if I can, then I'm going to stay in it. If not, then there's a waiting list for that race. Surprisingly enough, there's enough idiots out there that want to run 100 miles that, you know, somebody else could take the spot. And, but yeah, so I just went forward with the mindset of like, I'm going to do everything I can to do this race and to get myself back to that point, whether it's realistic or not, you know, and which was really great, like having Sean program for me, you know, you had reminded me from your back surgery, like, you know, like, hey, I had this mindset of like, I'm going to be super motivated and do this. And you know, and then you realize like how hard it was to actually like be motivated and train. Mm-hmm. And I went through that myself and, you know, it was good having you remind me of that because, having Sean program for me was like, it kept me accountable. Cause I was like, right. Here's this guy who is extremely busy. and sought after. And he, you know, like he's taking his time, he's taking time out of his day to help me. So I had to get my ass in the gym when I was supposed to, you know, and then, you know, but it was hard. I was just so tired after everything. You know, it was like one of those realizations that was like, man, no wonder, you know, like it's no wonder lazy people are so weak and weak people are so lazy.
Yeah.
It was like, I was so weak that it was just hard to do any, it was just so hard to do anything and it was so taxing. And then, and it, so you want to be lazy, you know what I mean? But that's also what's creating weakness, you know what I mean? So it's that kind of cycle. So, yeah, it was good motivation. Having the race as a, you know, kind of a carrot dangling in the future was like really a really positive force for me.
So dude, tell us about the race. Tell us about the race.
Okay. So the race, so it started off in epic fashion. So we haven't had rain in like Utah for like ever. And of course, like the weekend of the race, it's like calling for just buckets of rain and snow and all this stuff. It's in the northern mountains of Utah. You know, most of the race course, the original race course, like runs, you know, at and above 8 to 10,000 feet. And so, you know, it was going to be like super snowy and muddy. And this race particularly has had like some bad weather years, and the mud gets nasty if it's raining and all that kind of stuff. So we're kind of just prepared for, I'm just kind of preparing for like, all right, well, you can't control the weather. Like, let's just get at this thing. It's going to do what it does. So I was prepared for, you know, all the conditions and stuff like that, as far as like, I had lots of extra dry layers in case I needed to change for warmth. But other than that, like I kept my race plan really like more simple than I ever have. I didn't do any drop bags. You have a crew, and then you can have pacers from like mile 40 on or mile 36 on. Because sometimes these races have a 36-hour cutoff, and you know, if you go into those long hours, you can get pretty sleepy and, you know, get off course easily. They mark them with these like little flags and stuff, which are easy to miss if you're not paying attention and stuff. So, but yeah, so yeah, I've got like pacer. I've got three of my friends that were going to pace me. And then, so I'm like, they're ready to go. And my crew's coming up later that day. So I wake up, I get all my stuff prepped the night before the race. Like I have my clothes laid out, everything's like ready to go. And then I set my alarm an hour late.
Oh, I don't know if I knew this.
I don't think I've told you this yet. So I literally like I'm my alarm goes off, and I usually always do just a 1 5-minute snooze. Like I allow myself 1 5-minute snooze. You know, first 5 minute snooze goes off, second one goes off, you know, staring at my phone, and it's like, holy shit, it's 5:45. The race starts at 6 a.m.
Holy shit.
And so I jump out of bed, run straight to the toilet, take a pee, and I'm laughing while I'm peeing. I'm like, holy shit. And like me and my friend had had dinner, my friend Jeremy had had dinner the night before, and we were joking about like, if you're late for a 100-mile race, it's really not that big of a deal because it's so many hours,
right,
you know?
Right.
As long as you're not skirting that cutoff time, then you're probably okay.
Now, so, before you go on, do you still sit down when you pee?
I've started standing up using my man wiener, as you called it. I had to sit to pee in Peru for a little bit, and Michael made sure to make fun of me. And the first time I was like, I'm going to pee standing up. He's like, oh, you're going to use your man wiener. So I do. I stand up using my man wiener again, which is
nice, man.
But yeah, so I run from the bathroom to the door, you know, check the temperature outside to see like how cold it was, decide that I'm going to run in shorts, not tights. And, you know, throw my clothes on, we jump in the truck, and like I am like hauling ass running like stop signs and red lights to get to the starting line. And we get there, and literally as I'm walking up to the check-in desk at the start line, they call out 1 minute warning.
Nice.
So I made it literally just in time for the race to start. And then so race starts, it's raining, but not super hard, which was nice. You know, it's dark for the first like hour or so. I chose not to wear a headlamp, so I just ran. I ended up seeing some friends and just running with them for the first like maybe like 10-ish miles or so, or well, little more than 10 miles. And it's a group of people that I have like see in races all the time and friends of mine that I run with and stuff. And then there was also this other guy, Bryce, who like him and I, the last time we saw each other, it was a race in Moab, and I like was sprinting to the finish, and he like looks over his shoulder just in time to see that I'm about to pass him, and then I'll also start sprinting. So we had like a sprint off to the finish line, and like I'm pretty sure he won. He said we got the same time, but I'm pretty sure he beat me.
Bryce v. Bryce.
Yeah. So, So yeah, so like race morning, it was kind of nice not having, I didn't have a lot of expectation as far as like, I had my like internal goals of like what would be awesome and what would be cool if I had a good day. But I was also like very like, man, like I lost my physical base of muscle. Like, I don't know, like, the longest run I had done before this race was like 26 miles. You know, so I'm just like, I don't know, like I feel great, my body feels good, but I don't know how, like, am I going to be able to go 100 miles, you know? And because I just didn't know, like, I just didn't know at that point, you know, mm-hmm. Like before, like after my first 100 miler, like all the other ones, I was like, okay, now I can go 100 miles. Like, I know I've done it before, I can do it. This one, because of what had happened, it was just like, I think I can do it, and I'm going to definitely push as hard as I can to do it, but I didn't know. And but so we're running at a pace, and we're climbing this like this monster climb, and this guy Bryce starts to kind of like separate from this like group we're in, and I felt good, and I felt like I could go faster, so I'm like, cool, I'm just gonna stay up with him. And so him and I ended up running together for the first like 53 miles or something like that.
That's just cute. The couple of Bryces just running through the mountains together. Yeah.
This guy, like, everybody knows this guy in the ultra running community too. So like people would like say hi to Bryce as we'd like come through like aid stations and stuff. And it was nice, 'cause I thought it felt like they were talking
right,
to me.
Right. We've uncovered the link as to why you did so well.
Absolutely.
Affirmations. Yeah.
So, but yeah, so, you know, the conditions are getting like worse throughout the day. It's raining off and on. And it's getting muddier, and, you know, we're running through these parts where, you know, mud's sticking to your feet are like 15 pounds, like they're heavy and just like, you know, or feels that way. And, you know, we pick up, my friend Jenny, paced me. And so she's running with us, and, we do this monster climb up to the highest point of the race at a place called Tony Grove, and it's like dumping snow, it's cold as hell. And so I changed into like tights, Jenny changed her shoes and stuff, and so Bryce was like freezing because he ended up running the whole damn thing in shorts. So he took off. Damn. So that was the end of our like run together, but it was awesome. Like, we, you know, it was so cool to run with him, and that like definitely pushed me through that first part of the race, because we were kind of like pulling and pushing each other throughout, and kind of running with each other. And then, so then, you know, we take off down there, and, you know, it's just getting nastier. I switch out pacers with my buddy Scott, and he, the higher elevations, anytime we're getting to the higher elevations, it's snowing, and him and I miss a flag, as it's getting dark now. And they had rerouted the course, so it was an out and back course instead of a point to point.
So,
which can be advantageous if, like, 'cause you're like, oh yeah, I know this part of the course, except for you can easily forget lots of parts of the courses because it's all dirt trails and this and that. And so stuff starts looking the same.
You're looking at it from a different angle.
Totally. And you're getting tired and it's dark now, you're using headlamps. And so, we miss a flag and we climb up this like super steep dirt road and we go all the way up this thing. We haven't seen flagging in a while. We're starting, Scott's like, I just got a bad feeling. I think we're off course. And I'm like, no, I think I remember this hill. Like, I think I remember running down this. And so we go like way up to the top of this thing, and then we realize that we're like, no, this has got to be the wrong way. So we run like halfway down the hill, and then we run into some other runners who also had gotten off course, and we decided like, oh no, we must be on course. So then we climb the hill again.
No.
Man. So we ended up killing about an hour of our time in about 4 miles ish, and but we found where we went off course when we went back, and it was good. It kind of lit a fire, of like I really wanted to make up that time. We realized at that point, or just before that point, Scott had mentioned, he's like, dude, you could go sub 24 hours, if you keep your pace. And sub 24 hours in a 100-mile race is like kind of a, it's like kind of a standard benchmark of like to go for in a lot of races. It means you've done it under a day. It's kind of like a coveted, like, time for a lot of people. And I didn't necessarily think that was even going to be possible before race day, because I had done this race previously, and I think, and I in really good shape and feeling really good, and did it in 22 hours and 30 minutes. And so to be only an hour and a half off of that or somewhere in that range was like, I didn't necessarily like, that was a long shot, you
And
know?
another thing, you told me last week that in your training, your mile times were literally a minute slower than when you were training, and you set that other PR, that
Yeah.
22:30. You were running on average a minute slower per mile.
Yeah, at least, and sometimes more. Like I felt, even when I had felt good, I'd like look at my times and I'd be like, oh man, I'm still just running slow, and so yeah, so I, like I thought, like if I had like the greatest day I could out there, then maybe I'd do like 26, 27 hours or somewhere under 30, and so to be on that pace was like really exciting, and then to lose an hour was like, oh shit. So it was good. It kind of lit like a fire, and I felt really good. I've never felt that good at that point in a race. And so we were like hauling ass down the downhills and the flats and stuff, and just pushing really hard. And then we had this another monster climb up into the snow. It's like, at this point, it's been raining and snowing so long, like you can't, like your feet are just, totally wet and muddy. And as long as you're running, for the most part, they feel, you can like warm your feet back up. But we kept ha like it was impossible to avoid stepping in like these giant icy puddles and snowy slushy puddles and stuff. So, at any of the high elevations, like we're just, your feet are frozen. You can't, like, to open a goo or a gel packet, which is like what I ate almost throughout the race, that and potato chips and cookies. And I would literally have to open it with my teeth, and then I would have to use both hands to squeeze the gel out. My fingers were too numb to like squeeze. And yeah, and then when we get down to the warmer elevations, and then it'd just be rainy and cold, and it'd get a little bit better though. And but yeah, so we came through. It just kept dumping. We ended up doing, we ended up making good time on those positions, and I was still in a position where, it was getting to be a longer shot, but I was still within reach of pushing for that sub 24 pace. So that kept me like super fired up. And then I dropped Scott off in the last 13 miles, 14 miles. I ran with my buddy Jeff, and we had this like crazy climb out of that aid station and into the snow. The snow was really heavy. It was starting to bend all the bushes over the, over the trail and all that kind of stuff, which, at that point, trying to go be nimble and go under things is like, kind of painful. So we just started, and it was so wet and cold anyways, like we just started like running through those things. But yeah, so we're, you know, I'm trying my best to, like, you know, haul ass as much as I can up this hill, which is just a fast hiking pace. I'm definitely not running it, running hills at this point. And get to the top, and there's just this nasty downhill with, like, you know, just really pretty technical footing, and we're skiing down the top part of it essentially because it's snow and then mud. And as we're coming down this hill, like, I know as I come into this last aid station, you know, there's about 6 miles left after that. And I know going into this last aid station that it's going to be really, really close, you know, which is like a good thing and a bad thing, you know, because mentally you're like, this is awesome, I think I can still do it. And then at the same time, you're like, holy shit, like, I'm going to have to push really, really hard to do this. And we did, we got there, you know, we got there and I knew it was within reach still. And in my mind, like, this last part of the course had a lot of downhill in it, and that was not reality.
Right.
It was a lot of these rolling hills, which we, you know, which never seemed to end, which Jeff and I started naming, you know, things like Eat a Dick Hill and some other ones that I probably won't even mention, but,
yeah.
but you know, if it was downhill and flat, I could push a running pace. And then if it was uphill, I just couldn't breathe anymore. Mm-hmm. So I was just hiking as fast as I could on anything with uphill. And, the last mile of the race is on pavement. You come off this trail onto pavement and you have a good amount of downhill, and then like maybe a quarter, maybe a little over a quarter mile of flat, you know? And so we hit that pavement with 9 minutes left before the 24-hour mark. And, you know, 9 minute miles for your last of 100, is rough. And, but I knew it was possible. So Jeff and I just started sprinting down this thing. So I ended up sprinting out a 7 minute mile at the last mile, which the downhill part was okay. We hit that flat spot and it was just like, I couldn't breathe. I was just, it was so close, you know, it was so close. We just had to push and ended up making it with a minute 12 to spare before the 24-hour cutoff. And, you know, a bunch of my family was there, my friends were there, and there was many, many tears shed. Bryce had actually gotten lost too and finished just a couple minutes ahead of me, which was cool. Cause that was his, I think that was, he said that was his best finish at that race. And,
nice.
And you know, we both, you know, like credited each other for pushing. And, but yeah, it was just a really, really special moment. And, you know, definitely it's always good. It always feels amazing to accomplish your goals and even better to surpass them. And, you know, and to share it with people that you love, like it was definitely one of the more incredible moments of my life and, pretty cool. Yeah. So.
Amazing, man. I'm curious, did you notice, or are you aware of now, like any difference in the way that you were thinking during this race as opposed to, or, versus other races?
Yeah. Yeah. I think my attitude throughout the race was happier, more jovial, like than I've ever been. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jenny was joking with my crew. She's like, usually around mile like 50 or 60, like he gets grumpy. the race that you had come out and paced a portion of, you know, my girlfriend at the time, she paced the last portion of that for me. And I remember like when we set off, we were running on this dirt road. It's like the middle of the night, you know, it's just her and I, and it's like really quiet other than us running. And she had something jingling in her hydration pack. And I was like, I couldn't have it. You know, I was like, you need to fix that. You need to change that. Like, I can't hear that right now.
You know, only because it was her. You wouldn't say that to anybody else.
No, I mean, I was just so irritated, you know. It was just like, and I just never, other than the last climb and like where it was just, I was literally like it felt dangerously frozen.
Yeah.
Couldn't, you know, like numb feet and like I was like, we got to get off this mountain because we're gonna like die up here, kind of feeling, because of the cold. Like, you know, other than that, like I like. I've never felt more comfortable in a race. I've never felt, my body's never felt better. Like, you know, my brother and them have like accrued me before, and they're just like, you've never looked that good during a race. And and I think honestly, man, I was just so happy to be out there. When I picked up Jeff at an aid station, this guy who's, you know, awesome dude in the Wasatch running community, like he, Tommy Barlow, he's like, this must feel a hell of a lot better than in a hospital bed in Peru, you know, and he, that summed it up pretty perfectly. You know, I was just so happy to be out there running, man. Like it was such a treat to be able to just to even toe the line at that race and give it a try with like, an honest chance of like being able to finish the thing was like, you know, it just, it, my attitude towards it was the difference maker, I think. And it definitely, that was a good learning experience for me in this race and in life in general, as we're always learning that stuff is like the one thing that we have control over in any situation. And sometimes the only thing that we have control over oftentimes like is just our attitude, and our emotions towards something and that sort of thing. And yeah, I was just, I was so ecstatic and happy to be there. You know, that it made it easy to, it made it easy to suffer, because they were still suffering for sure.
Certainly, certainly. But it's attached to like a greater purpose.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
So for people that haven't gone through drug addiction, that haven't, you know, come so close to death, do you have any advice on like how people can tap into this power without having to go through some, you know, near death experience?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think the first one is just recognize that we're always close to death. You know, we're never like, and obviously like that, that becomes a more acute awareness, when you've brushed death, so closely. But if you've gotten in your car and drove to work today, if you, you know, did whatever you've done today, you've been closer than you probably think, and embrace that, you know, like embrace the fact that like life is precious and there's only, you know, we're not guaranteed another day, another moment. And so that's an attitude and kind of a belief system that you can like take with you or start to like look into, is that, you know, if I was to die today, like what would I regret? And then start working off the things, you know, to not regret those things. And I, you don't need to be a former drug addict or have like some crazy near death experience to access that stuff. I think, you know, some of us like myself are slow to learn that kind of stuff. And so I think sometimes I need those things to remind me, but yeah, we don't have to have those situations to recognize what is the truth anyways, you know? Yeah. So.
Yeah. So it sounds like your experience racing, like you were just filled with so much gratitude that you're even out there, which, you know, leads me to my next point, which is like, everyone has something to be grateful for. And I think you just have to, practice tapping into that more and more and more, and it doesn't necessarily happen suddenly. It certainly can, but by practicing gratitude through your actions, right? Like treating people as if you you really care and appreciate them, it develops this kind of this superpower in you, where you can you have more energy, more motivation, more passion for the things you love. And you can do amazing things like run 100 miles in under 24 hours when you almost died.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, like you mentioned superpowers, and like I get people all the time saying like, oh, you're like superhuman and this and that. And like, I don't believe that I'm superhuman, you know? I think like all of us, and I, you know, that's the benefit of coming from where I came from in drug addiction and stuff like that, is like, you know, everything that I experience now and have felt now has been the culmination of a lot of like internal work, a lot of personal work, you know, years of like mindfulness meditation practices and just being really, really open-minded, you know, of like, to trying different things in order to kind of like find that like peace within self and and challenge, you know, being uncomfortable, like finding, you know, finding ways to be uncomfortable so you can get comfortable with discomfort. And yeah, I don't think like it's not like, you know, it's just a human trait that we can all tap into. And I truly believe that, you know, anybody who wants to tap into that can do really extraordinary things if they, you know, take that, if they take that time to like work on that. Mm-hmm. So
talk about that comfort piece again. What were you talking about?
Just finding like comfort in discomfort, you know, from, you know, like at the root of it, like, I mean, I, you know, drug addiction is like, you know, I use drugs to numb myself because I was trying not to feel things, you know, I was trying not to feel uncomfortable. But life is full of, you know, it's full of discomfort. Mm-hmm. And so you can't, it's not something we can avoid. Uncomfortable emotions, uncomfortable situations, like those aren't things that you'll ever avoid entirely until you're dead, you know, and maybe not even after that, who knows? Like, and so like starting to embrace, you know, like, I think I was discussing this with a friend, like, I think one of the most amazing things, I was reflecting back on like being sober for 10 years and all the stuff that's happened this year. And I've cried more than I've cried this year, like this year than I have like any other year, but it's been like, a lot of it's been tears of joy and some of it's been sadness and stuff. And, but I remember feeling like really sad earlier this year about something and like crying and stuff. And like, there was a moment of like absolute beauty in that sadness of like, man, like recognizing like in order to feel this sad, I had to feel really happy and recognizing mm-hmm. like those polar opposites of like the polarity of like what the world is and how things are, you know, like the dualism of emotion and recognizing like just feeling all of it, you know? And mm-hmm. so, you know, you can take this attitude towards emotion, uncomfortable situations or uncomfortable emotions that, I don't want to feel uncomfortable and it's wrong to feel uncomfortable, but you know, all you're doing is avoiding something that's going to happen. And by avoiding it, you know, it's like, if I tell you like, don't think of the color red, Mike, don't think of anything red, you know, like you're probably
don't tell me what to do.
You're probably looking around the room, thinking like pointing out all the red things, you know, in the room, like you give it more energy, you know? So instead of avoiding that discomfort, just embrace it, you know?
Right.
And find a way to just feel it. You know,
mm-hmm. I love the idea of using different drills or experiences as ways to grow your comfort zone, right? Grow the sphere of your comfort zone, because really all of our biggest dreams, biggest goals in life, they require us to be uncomfortable, right? They require us to work hard, to sacrifice, to, you know, withstand like all kinds of negative emotions and thoughts over the years. And a lot of people are afraid of being uncomfortable, and so they never achieve. But as I was talking to Joe DeSena about, you know, the point of the Spartan race, like why did he create the Spartan race? One of his answers was to help people, you know, get outside of their comfort zone, which will help, you know, which will translate into every area of their lives.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you can, I mean, there's so many ways like that you can, you know, you can go get into some therapy and find discomfort that way. And then find other ways to be uncomfortable. You know what I mean? Like, or vice versa, you can go throw yourself into a physical event, like a Spartan race or a, you know, a CrossFit competition or a, you know, whatever, just something that's like uncomfortable, it challenges you physically and stuff. And there's going to be like, you know, if you look at it as like mind, body, spirit, like all of them influence each other, you know, mm-hmm. it's all one piece. And however you decide to get into that, you know, is a way to get into that. It's just doing the thing.
All right. We're going to wrap it up in a second. I have a few more questions for you.
Cool.
And I stole this from my buddy, Jared Moon off of the, I think it's the EO3 Fit podcast, something like that. And I just love this question. What one piece of advice would you give for people, to become a better person right now?
What one piece of advice I get? That's a great question. So there's so many like valuable answers here. I'm trying to like skirt through and figure out what's the one thing that I would give. Be kind. Be like super fucking kind to people, and that includes yourself. I think like you can access so much in life, just by being kind to yourself and in return to like other people.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's life changing.
Absolutely.
Know? I struggle with so much self-criticism and stuff like that. And like, and I think like when you're being self-critical, that begins to emanate out from, you know, how you're treating yourself inside will eventually be how you treat others outside, and vice versa. So, you know, just be kind to yourself, be kind to other people.
I could not agree more. I think when you're treating yourself correctly, right, you're treating yourself kindly, and then you go and create as much value in other people's lives as possible, not only does it fulfills you, right, it takes care of that piece in your life, but it's almost like you can use it in a selfish way, because it always comes back to you, right? You provide value for people, and they want to return the favor, right? They want to help you in business. They want to, you know, invite you over for events, whatever it may be. It always comes back. So I could not agree more with that.
Yeah, 100%.
What one message do you want to leave with these listeners? And a lot of these people are people that supported, you know, the GoFundMe, they were cheering for you, stuff like that. What do you want to leave with them?
The first thing that I would say to like anybody, like especially anybody who supported and stuff like that and followed it, is just thank you. And if I could leave a message that's like that has some impact and stuff, just remember that you were who you are, and the impact you have on this world is whatever you think it is, it's probably different, and it's probably like far greater than, like, you probably have a far greater impact than you believe you have on people, you know. I know that was like a huge learning experience for me, and kind of a squasher of that self-criticism, you know, was reading the hundreds of messages and things like that via Facebook and GoFundMe and all that, like, I kind of got this like amazing experience of like getting to, it was almost like getting to die and go to your own funeral and hear what people would say about you. And, you know, I remember like sitting in the hospital when I first, like got reattached to social media, and I think I could get through about 10 to 15 messages at a time. Before it was just like the emotion was so overwhelming, and I'm bawling and crying. And, you know, and I remember, I'll just share this moment because it was really powerful, you know, but I'm like, I remember laying in bed, in the hospital bed, and I'm just, you know, I'm reading these, and I'm crying like loudly. and my dad's like, are you okay? You know, I remember I was like, I don't think I'm as good of a person as these people think I am.
You know? You're really not. You're really not.
Well, you know, as they say, you're never as good as they say you are, or as bad. So,
right.
but no, I mean, it was one of those things where, you know, you do nice things for people, you do this and that, and sometimes in a world full of a bunch of bullshit, like it feels like it goes unnoticed or it doesn't matter, but it does. You know, it matters. You know, mm-hmm. And the little things that you've done for somebody that are kind, like, it matters, and there's probably people out there that really look up to you and this and that, and like, whether you believe that or not. So.
Awesome, man. Where can people keep up with you and or reach out to you?
So just basic social media stuff. I'm on Facebook under, yeah, just my name, Bryce Astill.
Astill.
Yeah, correct. And then Instagram, same, Bryce Astill. And then if anyone out there is struggling with addiction or wants to like learn some mindfulness or whatever it is, or has questions or needs some help in any way, like, you're welcome to just email me at bryceastill@gmail.com. I'm happy to help any way I can.
Amen, brother. I appreciate it, man. The guy who almost died and then ran 100 miles. Amazing, amazing. Guys, if you haven't signed up for our newsletter, go and do so. That's where we'll update you on all of our new videos, blog articles, podcasts, free programs, all kinds of good stuff. You can find that at brutestrengthtraining.com. Appreciate it, Bryce.
Thanks, man.